Hello again. Thought I'd read a bit more. Page 114 of the book. It is just you. Everything's not shit. Hopefully there's something funny or amusing in here. The story of the little mouse who knew it was none of his business. You may not be aware of this children's picture book, but I urge you to check it out. It's a work of genius. And one with an important social message to bestow. A mole surfaces from his burrow one morning, only to have another animal crap right on top of his head. He doesn't see who did it, and what with him being quite a short-sighted chap, so he sets off on a quest to find the culprit. To each animal he comes across, he asks the same question. Did you do this on my head? Pointing to the poo, which remains firmly in place. One by one they deny the charge, proving their innocence by depositing their own pile of poo as evidence. Eventually the mole turns to a couple of flies for help, who identify it as the work of Basil, the butcher's dog. The mole then exacts revenge by clambering on top of the kennel and depositing his own mole-sized turd on the sleeping Basil's noggin. Sounds like one of those Looney Tunes cartoons. Anyway, it's written by Werner Holzfarth and illustrated by Wolf Erbruch. This heartwarming tale carries an important message for children. If someone shits on you, then it's only right that you should shit on them. Hang on, that's not very nice. Oh well. It's a really funny book. The London Underground Map. Next time you are travelling by tube, take a few seconds to ponder the London Underground Map. Just think about the complexity of the information it conveys and how it does it so simply and effectively, while at the same time looking like something a five-year-old would draw with a crayon. The Underground Railway was opened in London in 1863, and the very first map to plot its lines simply inset the detail into a normal geographical map of the area. The map evolved over time as more lines and stations were opened, necessitating some kind of key. And as early as 1908, the bright colours coding each line were already being used. Although the map bore little resemblance to the one we use today, this basic format stayed in place for another 25 years until Harry Beck came along. Beck was an electrical draftsman who used his knowledge of circuit diagrams to put together a new map for the underground system. Something he did under his own initiative. The management were unsure about the public reaction, so on its debut in 1933, the printed map requested feedback from travellers. The response was overwhelmingly positive, and Beck's design formed the basis of all tube maps to come. Fascinating fact. The River Thames is the only overground feature that appears on the London Underground maps. Looking left and look right signs. When you walk the pavements and cross the streets of London and other British cities, you will often see the words "look left" in capital letters or "look right" painted onto the road. You may well take these for granted, and who would blame you? But here's the thing. They don't do them anywhere else. Makes you proud, doesn't it? Lost property statistics. These are both fascinating and amusing in equal measures. Following on with the London theme, because we are on the letter L after all, here are some of the items that ended up at the Transport for London Lost Property Office in one 12-month period. 24,084 bags and their contents. 20,846 books. 19,583 items of clothing. Well, we should sort of tell us exactly what clothing. I mean, you expect a cardigan or a jumper or a scarf maybe or something, but I wonder if there's any other things. Elastic's gone on your knickers, that sort of thing. Anyway, moving swiftly on. 14,112 wallets or purses. Oh dear. 10,614 mobile phones. Oh dear, that's awful. 7,505 sets of keys. Oh God, how many people got locked out? Well, 7,505 did. Anyway, 7,026 umbrellas. 6,118 pairs of glasses. Oh, that's annoying. 5,718 items of jewellery. 2,671 gloves, of which 474 were single gloves. Yes, because that's always happening to me. You pull a tissue out of your pocket and you lose one of your gloves. 303 perishable items. I wonder what they mean. Food? All of which, one must assume, have their own stories behind them. But the stories I'd like to know are those behind these missing items found on the TfL system during the same year. An exercise machine. An exercise machine. Perhaps they got it so far, and it was so heavy, they just gave up. A 14-foot boat? How did they even get it down there? Okay, a stuffed eagle. An urn with the cremation ashes. Oh, no! We forgot Auntie Maureen. She's still on the train somewhere. Which train? I don't know. Can't go back without it. You'll have to. A sack of sultanas. I mean, that's not just a bag, that's a sack. Somebody was in trouble for that. A wedding dress. Oh no. A park bench. I wonder if they unscrewed it from somewhere and nicked it. Tried to get it home to get it in the back garden and gave up halfway through. Ooh, a briefcase containing £10,000. Sounds like something from a spy movie. £10,000. I mean, do people actually pay? Perhaps it was somebody paying a kidnap ransom. Maybe they never got the back. Do you think still somebody locked up somewhere because they never paid the ransom? And a grandfather clock. Well, I mean, how can you forget a grandfather clock? It's like boinging. Boing. Well, unless it wasn't wound up, I suppose. the kitchen sink. Oh, I was just going to say that that's everything but the kitchen sink, but there was a kitchen sink left. I don't know. The next thing that's good about life is loud music in an empty house. Yes, no one to complain. No one to tell you they've had enough. It's simply put just here, it rocks. Lower league football supporters. I pity Manchester United fans and Chelsea fans for that matter. What sad, unfulfilling lives they must lead, knowing that every lost match means an earful at work the next day, and a season without some silverware is a catastrophe of epic proportions. The real stars of football are fans of lower league clubs. Many support teams that have never won any trophies ever. Let me repeat that. They have never won anything. My own team have only won a single trophy in their 100-year history, and that was in the third division, North Championships, over half a century ago. So why is being a fan of such a club so wonderful? Simple. Because any minor achievement is a bloody miracle. Finishing in the top half of League Two is something to celebrate. Drawing a Premiership team in the third round of the FA Cup is our Wembley final. Supporting a lowly club gives you so much more potential for a rapture. Perennial underachievers celebrate with much more gusto. Lush. That's a chain store. When a new branch opens, it makes stinky towns smell nice. The one in my town is in a mall, so it's all percolated air as it is. We're on to the letter M now. Making your own bread. You can take out all your frustrations and pent-up anger with a jolly good kneading, and then revel in your own creativity when you tuck into a nice warm slice of homemade bread. There are few pleasures more therapeutic and wholesome. And now, lazy people, you can simulate the same feeling too by investing in a bread making machine which will do all the work for you. Marbles. Marbles are the jewels and gems of childhood. Genuine games of marbles, drawing a chalk circle on the pavement, etc., are played rarely now. But the appeal of owning marbles doesn't seem to have diminished. In fact, there are many adult marble collectors, with particularly rare examples, fetching really high prices. I had some marbles. I think I've still got them somewhere. I haven't lost them all, in case you were wondering. Stephen Marbury. Modern sportsmen and women can earn more from sponsorship deals than they could ever make from their day job alone. Anna Kournikova famously became the highest earning tennis player of her day, despite never winning singles tournament during her entire career. Companies will pay successful sports stars millions of pounds to wear their shoes or their shirts or sweatbands in the hope that this will encourage the person in the street to spend a fortune on their brands. The fact that we have all come to accept the above scenario makes the case of Stephen Marbury all the more remarkable. Marbury is a basketball player with the New York Knicks, nicknamed Starbury, since he was a boy growing up in Coney Island. Conscious of the pressures inner city children face to spend hundreds of dollars on the latest Nike or Reebok trainers worn by their idols, Marbury teamed up with an American clothes chain to promote his own range of Starbury items. His brand of shoes sell for $14.98 and is supported by a whole host of similar items at affordable prices. In today's materialistic world, this is a remarkable stance to take by one sportsman. It is quite nice, isn't it? Meerkats. Meerkats are extremely sociable creatures. Their sense of community and desire to look after one another is a lesson to us all. Each member of the gang or mob has a function that helps the group as a whole. The most famous of these is the lookout. Only one meerkat who stands on his hind legs surveying the horizon and skies for any sight of danger. They got really popular after there was a wildlife show about the life of meerkats. They are quite comical as well. And quite badass. I mean, they beat each other up sometimes. Beat up different communities that try to go on their territory. Another thing that's good about life is the moments before waking. Those brief seconds just before you wake up properly, when your brain hasn't as yet to engage and you haven't got a single trouble or worry in the world. Monkey. Oh, I remember this. In the worlds before monkey, primal chaos reigned. At 6 p.m. on Friday, 16th of November in 1979, BBC Two broadcast an unknown Japanese television show that had was dubbed into English. It was to become the stuff of legend, which is apt given the source material. Monkey, or Sayakuki, oh dear, let me try that again. Sayuki, in Japanese, was the tale of a Buddhist priest called Tripitaka, who was sent on a pilgrimage to India to collect some holy scriptures. On his journey, he picks up a ragtag coterie of helpers: a monkey king, a pig spirit, and a sea monster. And together they make the dangerous journey, fighting off demons and helping villagers along the way. The premise was based on an ancient Eastern legend, and the show actually stuck quite close to the original story. The programme quickly became a hit in the UK. It already had been one of the highest rated programmes in Japan, and it was the talk of the playground and workplace every Monday. For kids, the appeal was the pantomime sort of violence and kung fu moves. For grown-ups, the same was true, but as few of them also noticed the underlying story as well. Viewed now, and even at the time, Monkey's an odd concoction. The priest Tipitaka was portrayed as a man, but was very obviously played by a woman. The voiceovers appeared to be taking the piss, but were actually based on the original scripts and were clearly performed with some affection. can't remember that. The huge helpings of Eastern mythology and Buddhist teachings were highly unusual for primetime family viewing. And it was an unlikely success, but a very big one. Oh, I remember it. Monkey magic. It was repeated millions of times over the years. The Japanese series ran for 52 episodes, but ended after the second season without the pilgrims ever reaching India. Only 39 of these shows were dubbed for broadcast in the UK. And nearly 30 years on, the show is enjoyed a new lease of life on satellite and cable channels, as well as being released on DVD. And these include the 13 missing episodes, which have now been tracked down and dubbed by the original UK cast. Oh, I didn't know that. The nature of Monkey was irrepressible. Fascinating fact. Who played Monkey in the original series, had a second and more successful career as a popular lounge singer in Japan. He's their version of Engelbert Humperdinck. I mean, he did have side bands. Engelbert Humperdinck had side bands, didn't he? Monkey had sideburns. Do you think he kept the sideburns? I thought they were sort of part of him, supposed to be a monkey. I don't know. Well, anyway, the last thing for the letter M is Mr. Men. That's what I remember about the Mr. Men theme tune. When Adam Hargreaves asked his father, Roger, what a tickle looked like, his dad drew a round orange chap in a blue hat with long, stretchy arms. And that was back in 1971. And one of the most successful children's book series was born, the Mr. Men books. And they've sold over 100 million copies worldwide. Roger Hargreaves wrote and illustrated 43 Mr. Men and then 33 Little Miss stories before his death in 1988. The true connoisseurs of the series will remember fondly the TV version narrated by Arthur Lowe. Ah, yes, I did like Arthur Lowe's voice. From Dad's Army. Well, that's enough for now.